Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans, it's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So before we dive in with our new guest, Chaos Coordinator and Garber are in the middle of a move, so we're recording this first week of February. You're probably not listening to it this week, but that is why they're not here. They're not boycotting. I haven't fired them. We like them too much. Plus, Stabby sends me food, and you know you can't beat free Italian food, right? That's a perk of being friends with them. She's a good cook. All right. So, James, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers?
Well, hello. My name is James Totten. I have a handle on Substack, Angry Jumpmaster. I write fiction. Near future war fiction to kind of start theorizing what's going to happen with all the advanced technology that's coming to warfare at warp speed.
Nice. So I'm guessing by the tag Angry Jumpmaster that you think leg lives matter, right?
I know leg lives matter. I started out as a leg. I was there was this mythical place called 9th Infantry Division at Fort Lewis, Washington. And it was a fun time to be in the Army.
I remember that back in the day. So when did you start off with? I guess you were a young lieutenant back then.
No, actually, I was a private. So I graduated from high school. I didn't know what to do. My father was in the mortuary business, and I wanted nothing to do with it. I joined the Army, and I went down with a close friend of mine, and he was able to get 25th Infantry Division Hawaii, and I had to go back and get my eyes checked. So I came back the next week and signed every piece of paper I could get to get to Hawaii, and I couldn't. And I eeny, meeny, miny, moed between Lewis and Drum, and I definitely won out on that one. And got to Fort Lewis and started out, went from E3 to sergeant in the same platoon, then went to recruiting, which is a wonderful exercise. Went to the 82nd after that and spent some great time there. Went to Europe. Germany for a while, and then down to Italy as part of the 173rd. Came back after 9/11 to Fort Bragg, Fort Liberty, and deployed shortly thereafter in 2003 to Afghanistan. During our time in Afghanistan, the big show kicked off in Iraq, so we were Sideshow Bob for a long time, and our six-month tour turned into an eight-month tour, and came back. My next assignment was at Polk as a observer controller. So I got frocked to first sergeant there and then put in a packet for officer candidate school, was accepted. And the guy that ran the school selection goes, you know, you're going to be an infantry officer. I said, well, I mean, you know, you go with what you know. I went to OCS. I was an Alpha company. It was a trip. It was like going back to basic training again. I had so much fun. And then infantry officer basic course, they called it Bullock 2 or Bullock 3 at the time. And then got assigned to Fort Lewis, Washington, and finally got on a striker platform. Then a platoon leader in a striker company. We went to Iraq in the 2007 surge and in Baghdad, up in the Diyala River Valley, and I think it was Al Asad Air Base. We kind of bounced because we were mobile. We kind of bounced all over the country. Came back, you know, thought about getting out. And my commander, my sergeant major approached me and wanted me to go back as a battle captain since they didn't have any captains. So I went back as a battle captain. I was a night battle captain for my battalion commander. And I made decisions before he got up. And they trusted me with a lot. And it was a very rewarding experience. Got out of the military, worked at Amazon for a bit, ran my own warehouse for a third party warehousing company. Worked for Boeing, had a great time working at Boeing until it wasn't a great time after the two 737 MAX planes crashed. Was laid off, bounced around a few jobs, and now I work as a military contractor and I train end users on how to use new equipment. So it's been a fun ride.
And so obviously you were military. So how do you feel like your time in the Army Specifically, I guess you spent all of it in the infantry. How do you feel like that affects the way you tell stories?
There's a lot of four-letter words. A lot. I had to learn how to talk again. F-bombs come flying. But, I've always had the natural curiosity, the geekdom, and the nerdiness. You know, somebody be going, oh, wow, that's a cool truck. And I'd be in the tabular data going, oh, man, it's got a 6.2-liter turbocharged diesel. And that's kind of what drove me. I mean, I worked as a private, as a specialist. I was a unit armorer. And this was back in the time before the M9 pistol was issued to everybody. We had 45s. So my first sergeant caught me with a completely disassembled 45, says, I'm going to come back in about 3 minutes. If you don't have that together, I'm going to fucking rape you. I said, okay. Put it back together, right? Always tinkering, always looking for some way, hey, we can make this better if we do X. And just wanting to improve the lot, you know, because as a paratrooper, as a leader, you get out in front of kids, old men, kids, whatever, you've got to earn trust. So I try to tell my stories from a position of trust, that the leader is successful because they've earned the trust, and the people follow not out of a specific desire to see what happens next, but because, hey, this guy, I mean, you know, mission comes first, but he's going to take care of me all the time. Let's go. And that has kind of been a driving force.
Okay. So were you light infantry or were you mechanized when you were in the
game? Was motorized. I was light. I've been everything but mech. So motorized light striker. I've dodged the Bradley fighting vehicle for an entire career. And kind of looking back now, maybe I should have been on one, but it's always an opportunity that may present itself later.
Did you ever get to play as a math grunt? I mean, mortarman?
No. I had mortars that worked for me, but never was a mortarman. It was always a rifleman or whatever you do in an infantry company.
I was more the just use it and believe and hope for the best. The mortars had to think too much for me.
I'm telling you. Those many red legs. I mean, there was a time when I was up in the Diablo River Valley and we were working there. We were in a combat outpost and we would fire illumination missions for the Iraqi army at night. They think they hear something. So we would launch, at the extreme range of a 60-millimeter mortar. We were launching illum rounds for these guys and it was so much fun. And then, we bailed them out at times, you know. Sometimes somebody comes up and wants to pick on the little guy, and then the American Army has to get involved. So it was an interesting time to be alive.
Yeah, I was there in 03 and 05. It was definitely a different time. That's when it was like a cornucopia of uniforms because the Army was between like three different ones at once. Yes. In 05. So we had some people there in the BDUs, some of them in the DCUs, the desert uniforms, and some of them were in the ones that looked like your grandma's couch, which was the AC something.
ACUs, man. Yeah. That is the stepsister of all the camouflage patterns.
In theory, it was supposed to make you not be able to be seen under IR, but you stood out like a sore thumb to the visual eye.
Oh, good gosh. Yeah. I mean, great experiment. Probably briefed well. They probably shot a bunch of money on it, but the OCP or Scorpion camo they have now just seems like a much better fit.
Yeah, it looks to be better constructed too. My nephew wears those, and I remember seams being an issue with the ACUs. One of the guys that was one of the senior NCOs in our company, he wasn't in my platoon. He always said, by the time if the Army's changed uniform three times in your career, it's time to get out. And then we get to Iraq, and there are like three different uniforms, and we're all just looking at him. I'm like, oh, so we're all going home now, right?
Yeah.
But who could have predicted that turbulent time of uniform change, right?
Oh gosh, they were, I mean, you know, cause it was what, the war on terror, man. They had money flowing. It was coming from an open spigot. So, you know, if they thought they had a problem, they'd throw $1 billion at it and see what happened next.
Yeah. It was like you said, that, and then the armor stuff, because we were there when they asked the Secretary of Defense about the armor. That one PFC got up on live TV, brave kid. All right. So you talked about like how your time in uniform and kind of what your experience was, how that affected the way you write stories. Do you ever draw from people you knew?
I have friends that we talk to sometimes. I mean, I don't claim to know everything, and research can only get you so far. So I have some good friends. Old NFO is a good friend of mine. Law Dog's a good friend of mine. And we share our experiences. And when you start theorizing or brainstorming a book, it helps to talk to somebody that's done it.
Right. And, you know, we all use subject matter experts. God love the SMEs. But I meant, like, do you ever draw on them as characters that you write into your books?
Yes. I've drawn on names specifically. I'll kind of mix up a first and last name of a person so it's not directly them or directly someone else. But I start thinking about the people that I know. And if you've been in the Army 20 some odd years, you know a lot of people. You know the superstars, you know the rock stars, you know the groupies, you know the flunkies. And all of them come together and in a unit because a unit puts the fun in dysfunctional. And they go out and do great things together. So it's very easy to draw on that experience.
So it obviously has changed how you write. Do you think it changes how you consume content as a reader, as a watcher of TV shows, like your time in the military?
Oh, gosh. So I remember when The Hurt Locker came out. And it's like, that never happened, and just like getting mad at the screen, watching it. But I think they actually did stuff stupid in that movie because they didn't want to give away the whole mode of operation for the guys that were in the OD. I can ruin a movie for people like that didn't happen. That's wrong. But what it's also done is when I consume content, you can kind of get the feel if somebody's seen the elephant or not. And when you're working with people that honor the elephant and know what it takes to go there and come back, it makes it more real for me as a consumer.
Yeah, I think you end up with some of it, they just don't know what they don't know. But there's also a part of it where if you tell some of the stuff that happens, like nobody would believe it if it wasn't filmed. And if you wrote that in, they would never. I've had things that happened to me that I had to edit out because the publisher was like, they're not going to believe that. I'm like, what are you talking about? It happened to me. I don't care. They're not going to believe it, JR. Yeah. So I'll give you an example. Do you remember when the guy was on the front page of the New York Times and he was a private in some unit in Afghanistan and he runs out because they started shelling his base and he's literally wearing the heart boxers and was wearing nothing else but his battle rattle and he's rushing to the flight or to the firing line and they've got him pictures from behind wearing just white boxers hidden in his boots and utes and his webbing and flak jacket and all that. That's literally, he was just wearing boxers over it. Yeah. If I wrote that in a story, no one believe it. If they hadn't had that one time that happened where the guy was there with the camera,
Yeah. I mean, I did that before when we were in Al Saad, Mortaritaville.
Yeah.
We get mortared all the time. And when we first got over there in 2004, we were living in these tents that were actual fire. I mean, they were treated with like whatever naphtha or something to give them a little bit of water repellency. And, everybody's scared the tents were going to burn down, but we'd get mortared and I just put on my battle rattle, my helmet with my PT shorts and walk out. My first sergeant chewed my ass. It was great. You will get dressed. You will get dressed now and you will get dressed, but what if we get shelled while I'm not wearing my body armor? I don't care. Get in uniform. Okay, got it. It's fun stuff.
Yeah. You get to be, because we were FOB jumpers, like we would go from base to base escorting convoys. So both of my tours were kind of, protecting the support element, sure. Which made us great targets. They loved shooting at us and throwing bombs at us. But they would generally stage you. And so most perimeters in Iraq, at least, because that's my experience, both tours were in Iraq, they would have the inner perimeter sandbag HESCO barrier fence, and that's where all the important stuff was. And then the outer area, which is basically the idea, if that's the dead zone where nothing important goes. So of course that's where they stuck the convoys because that was where the mortars could reach. And you got pretty good, we'd have those fold-out cots beside our trucks, and you get pretty good about like, it's not close enough, I'm going back to bed. And you just roll back over and you'd see the new guys. You can always tell because they're the ones jumping at everything.
Oh, I've got a story for you. Okay. So in 2007, when I was a platoon leader, I was in the tent, in the headquarters tent, talking to the company commander. Now, the insurgents at the time were taking the 122 millimeter rockets, and they were just placing them on a rock with a timer and launch and, range, angle, all this other stuff. It may hit the base. So they said, well, hey, this rocket's a lot bigger. it'll make a lot more. It was actually some kind of surface-to-air missile. So they leaned this thing against a rock, put a timer on it. Now, what ended up happening is it broke the sound barrier right over our tent. And I remember standing, talking to my commander, and I just kicked my feet out from under me and hit the floor. I thought we were all going to die. And I'm looking at my commander going, man, we got to quit meeting like this. This is bullshit. But that thing went screaming over the fob we were on. I think it landed like 10 kilometers downrange. Okay. But it was supersonic when it went over. It's like, oh my God. And, we got rocketed one morning before we went out on a mission. And my guys were coming back from the chow hall and they were carrying cases of Rippets. Drop the Rippets and run, you son of a. No, no, no. Because Rippets were life, man. That was good stuff.
We didn't have Rippets back then. Those weren't as popular. Everybody had the Red Bull.
Yeah. We missed out on the Red Bull generation.
Yeah. I don't know if any of it's better because I didn't really like any of it. We did the Folgers dip under the gums from the instant Folgers from your MREs. That was what we did. I look back. I can't look at instant coffee the same. I still get the shudders when I look at it. I still remember sweating. And you do the contest when you get back into the fob, when you get from base to base, where you take your flak jacket off, and you're like comparing salt stains on your uniform to see who has the coolest pattern.
Oh, my God.
We had one guy who swore he thought he had a pattern of Jesus on his uniform, on his back. I didn't see it. It looked more like a uniform to me, but, you know, you do you. It could be Jesus.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, we had some interesting times, so I definitely feel you. When we were there, the big deal was they'd use ice that would melt, and that was their timer because it wasn't impacted by some of the jamming stuff we had at the time because they were constantly call and response. We developed a counter to what they had, so they'd come away to get around it. And so the big deal.
Yeah, you had about 72 hours of knowing their TTPs before they changed their game.
Yeah. So it was the ice timers. So my cousin was out of Mortaritaville, LSA Anaconda, and so that was where we met because they sent us to chase down the mortars. They didn't like. I couldn't figure out why they were laughing at us, and sure enough, we got there, and it's just the melted water. It's very obvious it was a water timer, and we were just chasing our tail.
Yeah,
that's how they said hello to the new guys. They sent us to chase our tail.
Yeah.
So, all right. So the next part of the introduction, because we kind of went far afield, and I'm okay with it, was how we found him. So I actually met James through a friend of the show, Walt Robillard. He said this was a cool guy. We had to interview him. And it was an excuse to tell all the Leg Lives Matter comments that I wanted without getting hit. So I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And the rest is history. And now we're planning some cool panels. We're going to have him come back to get nerdy about drones and future warfare. So that should be a lot of fun. But before
I look forward to it.
I think it's going to be great. I'm going to see if I can put together a panel of eggheads and we can get nerdy with it. But before we get any deeper, sir, you have to answer the religion questions. Are you ready for this? All right. Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
Firefly.
Okay. Why is that?
It never got bad. It was one season. It was beautiful. It was put together, the movie Serenity, and it never got bad. I mean, the Star Wars, you know, the first trilogy was awesome. The second trilogy and the third trilogy kind of, I don't know. It's kind of like they wandered off the path.
The other problem with the Star Wars universe, and I think we've said this on the show a couple of times, but George Lucas never met an idea he didn't like. So he said yes to a lot of books.
Yes.
That if you follow in canon lore, like if Han, Luke, and Leia were over here on day one, and it's 12 days to get to point B over here, how are they there 9 days later? Like it just doesn't, the math doesn't math. So when Disney bought it, they had to almost ditch all of it to make it work. Now they could have tweaked all of that and kept a lot of it because there was some good stuff they got rid of, but it was the lore was never properly maintained, I think, and that was part of the problem. So you started getting the weird conflicting stuff and the midichlorians and all that other nonsense. I still like the idea of the large sort of space fantasy galaxy space saga deal. Like I think there's room there for a lot of awesome stories.
Well, look at Rogue One. How it just came out of nowhere and blew everybody's socks off. I mean, that's probably one of the best Star Wars stories out there. It's amazing. But I got to go with Firefly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Captain Maul, I like Firefly too. Man.
I just think Star Wars had so much missed opportunity to be even better than it is. So if you liked Rogue One, the Angry Staff Officer podcast that gets nerdy with a lot of history stuff, you can guess what they were doing when they had the podcast name created. They broke down the logistics of a lot of universes. They tore the heck out of the last season of Game of Thrones because the logistics just didn't work.
Yeah.
And they did the same thing to Rogue One about everything they got wrong and why the mission failed. Coming from like staff weenies, they were former infantry guys, but they were coming from like staff weenie positions when they were analyzing it. It's hilarious. Anybody that likes that kind of nerdy military stuff is going to dig that episode.
Okay.
So, all right, because we're polytheistic, Game of Thrones, The Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
Game of Thrones was incredibly entertaining. Made for TV, kind of deviated from the books a little bit, and I don't know if Mr. Martin's ever finished one. But I binged it with my wife before the seventh or eighth season, and we were hooked. She knew it was a great thing. The story of Khaleesi, the story of Jon Snow, how it all just kind of wove together. The Hound and the Mountain. There was a lot of good versus evil in there, and it appealed to me.
Okay. All right. And because we're civilized now, we're no longer the infantrymen who were knuckle-dragging troglodytes. So, coffee or tea, and how do you take it?
It's coffee, black. Just black. Just. I want it to show up on a piss test. That's how strong I want my coffee.
So. I make my coffee that strong, and then I mix it with creamer still. I had to cut back on the creamer because calories are a thing, and I'm sure. Dieting. I talked to, in fact, I had my appointment with my nutritionist this past week, and they're like, yeah, if you keep it up, the trajectory you're on, you'll fit back into your uniform by Christmas 2024. So I started thinking about it. I might just have to grow a mustache that's absurdly like poofy so I can put my uniform on, take a picture, and mail it to my former first sergeant. He wasn't quite Generation Kill levels of, mustache hairs, but he was close.
Generation Kill, man.
Yeah, that's the first. Great. I mean, we were there when they were like blogging in the war. It was a weird time to go to war with so much press and media available. I don't know that that's a good thing, but it was definitely an interesting time to be alive.
Yes.
So, but yeah, that's the plan. But yeah, hopefully I can get to that point. We'll see. Having said that, do you ever drink tea, or is it mostly always coffee?
If someone offers me tea, I won't turn it down. But, the Earl Grey tea, hot. I'm not.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you were a nerd when it comes to, like, you'd look at the tech manuals on the tech side of equipment. When did you start getting into, like, the speculative fiction, the sci-fi, the fantasy, the horror, all the things?
Let me see. So it was right after the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It disturbed me. It felt like a war that I was supposed to fight so this generation wouldn't have to fight it. That's kind of how I justified being in the Army for 23 years. I wanted to fight it in my time, so not my children, but my nephews. I had two nephews that were young and dumb and everything, and I wanted to do my fighting so they wouldn't have to. And then all of a sudden, here we go again. I think what really affected me, they were talking about the airfield that's kind of north and west at Kyiv, where the Russian paratroopers were supposed to go, and they just got blown out of the sky before they could jump. And it made me feel horrible. I mean, okay, they're Russians. Yeah, I dig it. But they're paratroopers, kind of like me. And just to think of those planes going down with all those guys inside, just it flipped me out. So I took some time. I had a good friend of mine in Law Dog, and he said, well, why don't you write about it? And I did. And what I found out going through all that was that all these complex emotions and feelings that I had because I was writing, I was able to explore those emotions on paper and kind of leave my mind empty of all the worry, the trouble, and everything else. And I haven't looked back since.
Okay. I can dig it. That's one thing I don't think people that haven't been the tip of the spear, because you could be in the military and not get what it's like to be in a combat unit. Yeah. For all asymmetrical warfare means even the truck drivers were by de facto combat units.
Yeah.
They didn't have the same mentality about it. If you're a truck driver, you train to drive trucks. If you're in the infantry, if you're in the army, you do one thing, you train exactly on your equipment to be as lethal as possible. And that is the job, period.
Yes.
And so for me, like I've tried to explain the idea that the brotherhood of the infantry of the combat arms is sort of transcends nationality. I mean, I could probably meet a soldier in the Wehrmacht and be friends with him because we have more in common than we do apart. And obviously the SS is a whole nother breed, right? But I use that as an example because Germans are the quintessential bad guy, the boogeyman, right?
Yeah.
And I still think the average grunt in the line unit there has more in common with me than Joe Sixpack in the middle of Arkansas who, you know, just never left home. And that's not an insult to him, salt to the earth, all that. But I just think something about having done those things crosses boundaries, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's 31 flavors at Baskin Robbins for a reason. You go for what you want. But when you get into the units, you know, because it's a brotherhood, hazing in limited quality. I mean, I believe in it.
Absolutely.
You know, not the, well, we're going to go and put tape on everybody's butt cheeks and rip off all the, no, that's not hazing to me.
That's just dumb.
That's just dumb. But I mean, give people the opportunity to solve problems that they've never looked at before and just tell them what you want done and then walk away and come back later and see how they did it. People can surprise you with their creativity and you want to foster that, but you also want the soldiers to band together, not exactly against you as a leader, but you want them to be able to work together. You may have a guy that, you know, is an American, but his family's from India and he loves naan. You may have a guy from, oh, I guess the Northeast that loves death metal. You may have a guy from Texas that, you know, thinks Rebel Yell is still a good thing. But these guys would never come into contact with each other except for the unit. And you learn a lot about yourself and a lot about others and how to make things happen, how to accomplish tasks. And I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah, it's, and, you know, you could almost get away with a lot if you could be funny about things in the military. So there was a guy that went AWOL for whatever reason, and they'd sent him on some lark. I think it was to find grid squares or something. And he comes back after he's been gone for a month dealing with whatever family they didn't give him leave for. Sure. And when they asked him where he was, he brought back whatever it was, like a civilian thing that happened to be named grid square on it. So he brought it back. I said, I found your grid squares. I searched high and low for it, First Sergeant. And sure enough, I mean, he didn't get a court martial. I mean, that's the kind of thing, like, in theory, yeah, sure. But because you had a sense of humor about things, that, and that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you do for hazing, you know, nonsense stuff that just, I went through it. Now you will too, sort of passing the experience along.
Oh no. What I loved was, here's a hammer and a piece of chalk. Now I want you to go over here and tap on this armored vehicle. And if it sounds different, that's a soft spot. I want you to circle it. So after about an hour of this, the commander would show up and go, what the absolute? And you know, it was shenanigans after that, or a bag over the exhaust to get an exhaust sample.
We used to do that to the new guys.
Yeah. Oh, you can't give away all the secrets because it's a new generation now. They got to learn for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. The other one we did is if we had officers we didn't like, because, you know, I know there's a trope, and I've got a friend of mine who's retiring as a colonel in the Air Force, and I realized that I leaned a little too heavily sometimes into the trope about the officers or the idiots, because I had good ones too, but, you know, it's a trope as lieutenants are stupid for a reason. And we had one who was like that. He wasn't like a bad guy. He just wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. So they put a stick through the lock mechanism of the porta potty and they tipped it over with him in it. I laugh about
you're
that.
You're a still. Smurf.
Yeah. He had a sense of humor about it once he was clean.
Yes. Yes.
And the middle time it was a little contested, but you know, we of course nobody saw who did it. Funny how that works.
Of course no one saw.
So, all right, we're going to pause for a moment where we air the commercial and we're going to jump back in and we're going to talk about your awesome series, which brought us here. And then we'll go for however long it takes to nerd out over this, because I think the idea is awesome. But for now, the commercial.
They promised him one weekend a month. The House of Reason swore the Ninth would never leave their gentle home world. But after Kublar, things changed for Sergeant Fetch and the Caledonian Reserve Legion Corps. Thrown into a meat grinder conflict in a desperate bid to hold the line, It doesn't matter whether you're reserve or active, only that you kill and survive. A searing tale of combat and honor at any price from a wounded veteran of the war in Iraq who fought to keep the MSRs open from Mosul to Tikrit. The Reservist, an Order of the Centurion Galaxy's Edge standalone novel.
All right, thank you for sticking with us through that commercial interlude. I tried to find, I thought originally you were with Wargate Press, so I loaded that in because it's the same company. And then you're like, oh, no, it's Rack and Tour. I'm like, I don't have a commercial from him yet, so oops.
Well, I'll tell you, give it a minute. He'll figure something out.
Yeah, well, I make that offer up to a lot of the independent creators because I spread the word. So first, before we dive into the Breaching Ain't Easy series, is that the only thing you've written or do you have other stuff out there?
There's only one other. It's a short story that's in one of the compilations or anthologies that came out. It's a story about it's about 4,500 words about a person, a young man that goes through war and tries to relax, and he happens to try and relax to on the island of Malta. And, you know, that's all this mystery and magic and everything surrounds Malta because of its history, and ends up meeting an actual succubus. And things go from there.
Isn't Malta connected to the Knights Templar, if I remember correctly?
Yes.
Yes. That's what they retreated to, right? After they were kicked out of Jerusalem?
Yes.
Okay. I thought so. All right. So is that in any way connected to the Breaching Ain't Easy series?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No, not at all.
So you mentioned a little bit about how you started writing. How did the origin of the Breaching Ain't Easy series come about? Was it literally just watching the news and then it sort of, you went down the rabbit hole of ideas?
Yes. Okay. So, and plus working with a couple of combat engineers and sappers, just to hear them talk about it, to see how the press, the minefields that the Russians can create are catastrophically large. And because of our war on terror experience, we can clear a route, but can we clear a minefield? And I came up, well, what if, and if you're a Ukrainian fan, don't hate on me. What if Ukraine actually got steamrolled, Poland got steamrolled, and then NATO did Article 5 and had to go back and recapture that? And that was kind of the whole thing on the first book. And then I started reading about the M1150 assault breacher called the Grizzly, and I'm just going, this thing is awesome. You do not know how big that thing is until you look at it or stand next to it. It is giganormous. And the power that thing has to just create a path through a minefield. Now, you know, it's not going to clear 100% of the mines 100% of the time, but it can definitely do some damage to a minefield. And my first story, Breaching Ain't Easy, Micklicks and Big Bears, followed a company commander and an assault breacher unit at the tip of the pointy thing going back to the east from Germany and how they led 7th Corps in the assault.
Okay. So this is obviously near future then.
Yes.
Did you write it in such a way that it makes it age well, or is it going to be like, I'm just thinking the Harold Coyle did his World War III novel, that armor that didn't age well, mostly because the tech in the, you know, early days of the USSR kind of thing. Do you think this one's going to stand the test of time?
I don't know. It's remains to be seen. There's still a lot of just unknown unknowns right now with that whole situation in Eastern Europe and the NATO allies and how things shake out. I hope it doesn't age well. I don't want to see it happen.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that won't be here if it does.
All right. And I just did a quick Google that I got the name wrong. It's Harold Coyle, Team Yankee is the book.
Yeah.
I remember reading that as a kid and it was, I mean, I loved it, but you know, you go back and you read it now, it's like reading history more than it is just fiction at this point.
Sure.
And that's always a danger with near future, is that it won't age well. Yeah. So with the invasion, did you address the idea? Because you know, you mentioned Article 5 with NATO. There is speculation that if that's ever invoked, nations won't answer, because you know, everyone remembers what devastation World War I and II did to Europe.
Yes.
And there's speculation that if it ever actually was initiated again, most countries would be like, peace out.
Yeah. Well, by using Seventh Corps or a reestablished Seventh Corps in Europe, I turned this into an American operation, a combined arms operation going from west to east. There's a lot of uncovered space for what did the Germans do? What did the Polish do? What did the English do? You know, so brainstorming, I've got hundreds of stories to tell. So hopefully I'll get better at storytelling. More people will buy it.
Absolutely. So are you going to keep playing in this universe, you think?
For now, for the short future. I mean, I kind of look back to the 70s. So you mentioned Team Yankee. I'm going to date myself. It was Don Pendleton, right? Don Pendleton and the Executioner series. And it's like he had a novel come out every other week. You know, Dallas Devastation, Denver Destruction, you know. And, you know, come to find out he had folks writing for him. But I would like to do something along those lines. You know, maybe a story for people with short memories or people that are easily distracted. It tells a story. And you can go, yeah. And then you can set it down and pick it back up again, maybe on a second reading, and just start going down your own rabbit holes. Like, how did that happen? How did that happen? Oh, my God. And just be entertaining. Absolutely be entertaining.
Okay. I mean, that sounds interesting. So are you going to stick with, in this universe, the American point of view? Or do you think you're going to cover some of the allied nations?
I'm honestly going to take a worldview. Because I have a feeling that if this really kicked off in Europe, that some other people, some other countries and organizations in the world will take their opportunity to raise up and see what they can get away with. One of my prequels in the series, Crimson, Red, and Navy Blue, it kind of discusses the fiction of China takes their shot. America's distracted. China takes their shot for Taiwan. And what do the... what did the United States Air Force and the United States Navy do about it? And it was a lot of fun to write. It was a lot of fun to write.
You also have the potential because if the military actually if the government actually declares war officially, the Coast Guard can be federalized as well. It can be brought back under the Department of Defense and be a Navy asset again. So yes. You have room to show what the Coasties are doing. Most people forget that they do more in war than just the coast.
Oh, listen, you know, and you can watch current events and see what could potentially happen. So it's kind of part, you know, being a nerd and having a weaponized imagination and then look at the news and then, oh, my God, we can do this or we can do that and come up with different scenarios. And there's stories in there. There's so many stories in there that you can tell from the small unit to a core. It's just amazing the amount of material that can be generated from this fictional universe.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is interesting that I don't actually think I've seen anyone do is telling stories from both sides. I know Jonathan Brazzi and Richard Fox did it in where it was a braided novel where it was two points of view wedded together, the officers from each side. But it's like a general rule. It's the only one I've even heard of that covers both sides of the conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I could see on this side, the Russian point of view is going to be different from their side and what they're seeing than we are. China's going to have a different point of view on what and why they're attacking. And to see that from the average grunt's perspective, I think could be fascinating at the tip of the spear for them.
Yeah, it's, again, the possibilities are limitless.
Well,
and it makes a great playground for the mind.
Absolutely. So before we show the covers and we talk about the art, what would you say the age range for these stories are as far as like families listening at home? Is this right for my kids?
I would say 18 and up. Okay. I wouldn't want, I mean, but I don't know. People now are maturing so much faster, but 18 and up, please.
Is it the violence or is there, you know, the cussing, or is it
the violence? It is ultra war today. I think what they call it. It'll come to me, but you know, they're talking future war and ultra violence. And you know, the intent of a war is to go ahead and inflict as much damage on your enemy as fast as possible to make them decide to quit. You honor your enemy by killing them quickly. You know, it's not something to play around with. You know, those with cruel intentions don't make it. And, you know, at the end, when you're policing the battlefield, if you come across a wounded combatant, you treat them and take them prisoner. You don't just friggin' double tap everyone because, you know, oh, we don't take prisoners. I don't like that point of view, and I've never understood it.
Yeah, it gets tricky to determine when they're out of the fight when you fight people that use asymmetrical tactics like suicide vests, and
yeah,
that happened in Haditha where they, you know, they were play dead kind of thing. Yes. It definitely gets murky, but I think as a general right, Geneva Convention exists for a reason. We try to stick with it where possible.
Yeah.
So we're going to show the art, and then you could tell us like the story of where this art came from. And I mean, it's glorious looking. So we've got your first one. This is one of your prequels, I believe, correct?
Yes, it is. That's actually sixth in the series, and the Sky Soldier. So I wanted to pay a homage to Airborne. Wanted to pay a homage to the people that support the Airborne, to everything that it takes to put an Airborne assault together. And so really an Airborne assault wouldn't happen in the daytime. Okay, let's be real. But we wanted to show the action. Cedar Sanderson, Miss Cedar Sanderson took the, I sent her like half the book that I already written before it was edited. She got into that, read it a little bit, and she captured the action of an airborne assault in ways that I never could. She updated the square parachutes rather than the round ones, and how the paratroopers always run into the fight. I've got goosebumps looking at it. So yeah, I was very impressed with the artwork.
This is the kind of art you could put on a poster and a wall, and it wouldn't stand out of place with your other Army memorabilia kind of image. I like it. It's well done.
Yeah.
So then we've got book one's cover. And is this the Grizzly?
Oh, yes, sir. That is the Big Bear himself. So it's basically an Abrams chassis with a modified turret. And on the back of that turret, it's been extended to the point where they can put a Micklick or a mine-clearing line charge. Two of them on the vehicle. It's got the plow on it right now. It's not really engaged, but you just look at one of these things. They're just a massive amount of physical violence all in one package. And the fact that that artwork turned out like that, I was amazed. That was my $15 artwork.
Wow.
So what I did is I Googled, how do I get cover art? And I Googled who does the best cover art cheap, because I didn't have a lot of money for this. And I sent a lot of pictures and a lot of descriptions and everything. And this came back and I was gobsmacked. So it was very, very well done. For it was amazing. $15 investment. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And then this is the cover two.
Okay, so Easy Eights and Breaking Track, it kind of follows my main character. Getting shanghaied into doing something that she might not have been prepared to do. But, you know, in the first story, she was injured and she had to recuperate. And then somebody said, hey, I need a captain. Oh, I've got a captain. And everything comes to fruition. So one part of the movie, or excuse me, not the movie, God, I wish. One part of the book was, okay, let's make an Abrams just to fight in the city. Let's make an Abrams with a different cannon. So I was looking online, and you have Bushmaster weapon system. So they got the 25 mic that's on the Bradley. There's a 30 mic that's on a Dragoon. They have 40 mic and 50 mic. So I said, okay, let's make a turret unmanned for an Abrams, and we'll call it an Easy Eight, like an M1A3 Easy 8. So the Easy 8 harkens back to the World War II Sherman, where the Easy 8 was the one that had the high velocity 76 millimeter gun, similar to the tank and Fury. Well, this one, I wanted to put a 75 millimeter Bushmaster cannon on it. I wanted to have, you know, high angles of, it could elevate high, it could traverse quickly, take the advances in target detection, target engagement. And, you know, a 3-inch cannon with a sabot round with today's technology, I don't see why it wouldn't go through both sides of a T90. And in the city, so harking back to Fallujah. So the guys in Fallujah from 2-2 Ramrod, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Infantry Ramrod, they wanted the TPT rounds to use in the city because they had a high explosive. The construction was a lot of rock and a lot of rock of the building. So the high explosive would impact the outside and wouldn't have any effects on the inside. But when they switched to Sabo, it goes through that house and 3 other houses. So they wanted just a solid punch through the wall. And, you know, so a 3-inch cannon with a dual purpose high explosive shell, programmable airburst type high explosive shell and Sabo, especially with a high rate of fire, let's say 3 rounds and under a second and a half, can really cause a lot of damage to a target. And, you know, because it has high elevation, higher traverse with a shorter barrel, it could get on a main street and really work, a building made as a defensive position. It could do it from a range where the enemy wouldn't have much effects on it. So I went down that rabbit hole and came out with this. So Easy Eights was my homage to the World War II, and the breaking track is, you know, if you've been mech and break track, you got to do it, but it is a pain. So I wanted to go down that rabbit hole, and it led to a very interesting story for me to write.
Nice. All right. And then we've got book 3, Old Heads and Drone Drivers. That is some amazing art. This was Cedar again, wasn't it? Cedar.
Oh, you bet. You bet. She sent me the, like, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And I about fell out of my chair.
So how do you explain the beard and the mustache? He's Merc? Civilian?
No, he's an old head. So I've got an ODA 13, and it's a group of Special Forces veterans that had retired. And because of the wartime, you can't just snap your fingers and have Special Forces guys. I mean, these guys, I mean, you look at the Tim Kennedys or the people such as that have retired. And if you got to throw a war real fast, the quickest way to get your numbers back up would be to pull those guys back in, because generating baby SF guys, you know, shake and bake at Fort Liberty is not going to fill the need. So that was the impetus for that. You know, the big bearded Santa type guy that's going to go in and do the direct action missions that nobody else can do. So there was the old heads. So the drone driver portion of it was, I kind of went down a rabbit hole on YouTube with the M5 ripsaw. So they have the ability with an M5 ripsaw tank. It's smaller, lighter, currently all electric. So what I did is, oh no, we're going to go diesel hybrid, you know, because you can't bring a bucket of electricity to recharge a tank if it runs out. And what I was trying to do is go with a ground version of Boeing's Loyal Wingman. I think it's Boeing Australia. So where an operator or in that, the pilot is a quarterback, and he has 3 to 4 loyal wingmen with him that he can send to do the dangerous stuff that would be too much of a threat for him and his multi-bazillion dollar aircraft. But the drone, who's relatively inexpensive compared to whatever stealth fighter we have next, I just flipped that and said, let's do it in ground. So in my research, there was some stuff. The Russians used some drone ground unmanned vehicles in Syria. It was a little monster looking thing with cannons, flamethrowers, and all this other stuff. It looked like Killbot. And they didn't have very good success with it, but they kept a tether to it for communication unjammable. For me, with the Easy Eights and Breaking Track, one of the things that I brought, you know, forward fictionally was a combat vehicle crew member's helmet that would have, let's say, like a Microsoft goggle package that would connect to cameras outside the vehicle, similar to what the pilots of the F-35 have, where they can look down and see down. So what if a tank driver didn't have to, oh, somebody's got a ground gun me back. Nuh-uh, this combat brother, look over your shoulder, throw that thing in reverse and go, you know, it would give, I would think, a generational leap in mobility. You can see what's going on. And like what the Israelis are finding out now, I think the Hamas, they love to get close and try to destroy their active protection system so they can hit them with an RPG. And if you can't see outside the tank, because as soon as somebody sticks their head up, they're going to get popped by a sniper. So all that stuff together. Now let's take that technology, put it in a 10-ton tank with a 50 millimeter Bushmaster on it. Something that's quick, that's quiet. You've got a human in the kill chain, and working in teams of different types of drones. You can have an engineer drone. You can have an air defense drone. You can have a tank drone. You can have an indirect fire drone. And you using these in kind of groups of 12 to 20 vehicles, such as a company, you know, you could have what I call the circus, where the operators are, you know, virtually inside the tank as it's in combat. I mean, there's no haptics, there's no direct connection to mind. I mean, we're not going all Tesla tech here, but you've got the less threat to human life ability to accomplish dangerous missions. And because, you know, you're fighting an enemy that is in a normal, let's say, T-90. One of the tanks I brought fictionalized on the Russian side was a T-95. Basically, it's a cheaper Armada with a lengthened chassis. Everybody sits in the hull. The turret's unmanned. It doesn't have a 152. It has a 125 because that's what we got. And instead of using that ammo cassette that's in the floor below the turret on the current generation of Russian tanks, they say, well, this sucks. Let's put it, you know, a bustle rack that has a ram that can load the rounds out of the bustle rack. So if the explosion happens, the turret comes off, but our three guys in front survive. And you kind of go down a rabbit hole and come out with a story where men still affect things. And then where men have to be there, they have to be involved. But you're doing it with drones from a distance, and it was a lot of fun.
So from your idea of this, are the drone operators like the drone pilots now in the U.S. somewhere, or are they actually near the front lines?
Oh, I have them within 10 kilometers of the front line. So I call it a circus, and basically it's like an electronic gold mine of computers, computers, transportation. You have the geek squad that fixes the drones. You have to have security for it because, you know, if they're all immersed in their virtual reality, if somebody attacks them, they're just helpless. And then, in later times I discover, okay, well, what if our combo's not secure? What if somebody knows where we are? What happens then? And again, it's going down the rabbit hole, but it's a fun place to be.
So we have the next cover, because we're just going through all of them. It's very nautical for all of our sailors and swabbies out there.
I have to congratulate first Cedar on this cover. I kind of gave her a description over the phone, what I wanted and everything. I never expected to come back looking like this. So this whole thing is a prequel. And this happens right after the cataclysmic events where the Russians go through Ukraine and Poland. They use a few nukes on the United States. China sees their shot and takes it. They're going for Taiwan. Well, we have the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force. What are they going to do about it? So I war gamed that with some friends, and this is what we came up with. The technologies involved. Well, we have a B-21 Raider, a sixth generation aircraft that's a bomber. What can it do? We have this future air dominant spider that's in prototype form for the Air Force, but you know, it's actually flown. What about that? And then one of the things that I fictionalized on my Angry Jumpmaster page was the Boeing F-39 Valkyrie space fighter. So it's something you could put on top of a booster, put it into orbit. It has different weapon systems, and they can use that to affect, you know, they can take out the eyes of the enemy as far as satellites, other other countries' space fighters. One of them I have is Russian, based on the Buran. In the pre-Cold War, they were really trying to get a copy of the space shuttle. So I take that to an ultimate conclusion and have a few things with that. And then what happens if they drop tungsten, 6,000-pound tungsten rods from space onto targets? You know, the rods from God. So all of that combined with, what does the Navy do? Let's do an alpha strike. How does Taiwan defend it? You know, and it again, it's a lot of action crammed into a small space. I'm trying to learn character development at the same time, trying to give the why. Why do I do this? I kind of explored it in Old Heads and Drone Drivers, and I'm really into it now with this. And it's very I think it's an entertaining story, but everybody likes their own brand, so I'll let the public decide.
You know, when you described all that, the one thing you didn't talk about?
What's that?
Nobody cared about the Space Force.
I know. I had to get them involved. I mean, you've seen the uniforms. They're Class A's, right?
Yeah, they look – I don't know. I'm not a fan.
They should have gone straight Star Trek and just, you know.
Yeah, and I don't know. There were a lot of missed opportunities when they were developing their branding. We'll say that.
I agree.
But they didn't ask my opinion. I'm just saying, though, if they start putting out recruiting ads where they're looking for door gunners on the shuttle, I might squeeze my fat ass back into a uniform for that.
Yeah, I'll have to get a birth certificate and lie about my age, but that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. And then this is your fifth book. Is this another prequel?
No, this is actually the one that comes after Old Heads and Drone Drivers. So it's retaliation. Okay. So right now I have a bunch of combatants on either side and everybody wants payback. How are they going to get it? One of the things, you know, well, Seventh Course is spent. We've reconstituted a Third Corps and we've got them in Europe right now. And one of the units I explored for that was the 49th Armored, which is Texas Army National Guard, and 36th Infantry, that is Texas Army National Guard. And so I kind of got in the habit of calling Texans because I have the Guard unit pretty much coming from the southern side of Texas. You know, they were activated, they were trained, they were given all this great equipment, and we were going to turn them loose in Europe. And then it's cheesy, man, but I've got some historic references in there. I just, being a son of Texas, I had to throw it in there. And then on the Russian side of the house, you know, what if Zhukov has a grandson and he's a general? How are we going to charge into this battle? How are these two forces going to meet? What's going to happen? And then, you know, it turns into a cataclysmic battle where basically both sides fight themselves out. You know, I'm kind of, I want to say this, I wax philosophical about the destruction, but there's times when I think about it and it gives me nightmares, you know, but I want to, like I said, I'm exploring the ground drones. I'm exploring the space. I'm exploring the mechanized side of what the Russians are doing, what the Soviets are doing, you know, and it again gives you a lot of rabbit holes to go down, but it was very fun to write.
So is this universe Eurocentric? You're focusing on the European campaign? Does
No.
it go global?
No, not at all. Because Breaching Ain't Easy, back when I believe it was Reagan in 83, I could be wrong, when they bombed Syrian forces or Lebanese forces in the Bekaa Valley that were sending intruders in to drop bombs on air defense positions. And if you remember, a Navy pilot, A6 Avenger, got shot down. Intruder got shot down, and one of the pilots survived. The other did not. And they made a big deal of getting him back. And then, you know, it was... everybody was embarrassed. You know, this is 1983. It's a friggin' wonderful looking family, multiracial family at the White House talking to Reagan. And everybody's like, what the hell? And you know what? Love finds a way. but it was an educational event for the country to see, you know, a black man and a white woman married out in public, being recognized, and, you know, it's caused change in our society. So one of my friends goes, yeah, after that happened, we were going to jump into the Becca Valley and seal it, and then the Marines were coming in, and we're going to kill everybody. So that's the basis for the story. And it comes across as a shaping operation for the Breaching Ain't Easy book, because it's a shaping operation to pull reinforcements down from Europe into the Middle East and give the fighting chance to 7th Corps and 3rd Corps to go east.
So I could see in any kind of World War situation, mm-hmm. a lot of the Islamic states would take the opportunity to vent their rage on their various enemies. Mm-hmm. Like Iran and Iraq have a long-standing dislike of each other. I could see that kicking off. I know India and China butt heads frequently over the border. You could see that taking a chance there. I'm just thinking there's lots of powder kegs in the world that are just looking for a match to justify going off.
Unfortunately, you are very correct.
So there's lots of room for that. Heck, you might even be able to justify a story about us finally invading Canada and making them part of the U.S. Just for the fun of it.
I'll put a pin in that.
Yeah. I guess I'm Canadian, so I give them a hard time. Yeah. You obviously mentioned some of the social issues that factor into the book. So do you address like the fact that you'd probably be drafting in a World War III situation?
Yes, drafting. In my storyline, it's under a Biden administration, and Mr. Biden unfortunately disappears. Air Force One takes off. Nobody knows where he's at. Kamala Harris is thrust into the part of being president. She drags Gavin Newsom out of California to be her vice president. Okay. Puts Gavin in charge of the war. I mean, they invoke the War Powers Act, and Gavin gets to direct industry. Some of the industrial parts of America have been destroyed, where we build tanks, where we build, you know, weapons. And I kind of use South Korea as an arsenal for democracy. They're building great tanks. They're tanks, artillery, fighting vehicles, things such as that. But they shift their production to designs, American designs, and improving upon American designs. And because of their industrial background and how they can switch on a dime to build something, they pump the stuff out. And it's, you know, I have some interaction between world leaders. Again, my intent is not to alienate anyone politically. I mean, you do that and all you do is, you know, half the world doesn't want your book then. I don't want to do that. So I'm going what if, and I'm not following politics as a religion for anyone. I'm just, like I said, it's fiction, and I'm just coming up with things that happen, and hopefully it's very entertaining.
So obviously we have the 19th Amendment, women can vote. Then in recent timeline, they put women in combat arms. So the deterrent from putting women as draftable is no longer there. It's come up for a vote several times. Do you address that? And this is not from a political angle, because obviously we stay apolitical too. Do you address that, what that might look like if they decide they start drafting women? Do you leave that out? How do you
handle it? I leave that out for now. I mean, but the unspecified intent is that they draft everybody. Right. Okay. And, you know, you get a mix of that. In some of my other books where I look at our allies, how they draft everybody. You know, this is not a little party that we're just going to get dressed up and go to. I mean, it's everybody come and we're all going to get down and see what happens next.
So if you don't realize, dear listener, every male on his 18th birthday in the U.S., because I know not everyone listening is from the U.S., fills out the Selective Service card, which essentially is putting your name in the draft roster. So you have a list of all the eligible males, because they all fill it out, or you can't get student loans, you can't get a lot of things. I don't know what's I was already enlisted because I enlisted at 17. Yep. So I'm not sure because I didn't have to read mine because, like I said, I was already in. I know there are a bunch of negative consequences if you don't fill your registration out. So they already have all that data. They wouldn't have that on the ladies. So if you decide to draft that, I mean, we're just looking hypothetical futures. It's definitely going to be a cluster of them trying to figure it out. I don't know if you remember the surge. One of the things most people don't realize is when they notified all those people that were called up out of the IRR, the inactive ready reserves, they didn't have any mechanism in place. They used what they had set up in Vietnam. People got Western Union telegrams. I mean,
yes.
So that's one of those things where that you tend not to update until you need it. And then it's like, holy crap, we should have done that last year. We need it now. Mm-hmm. So it would definitely cause some upheaval if you try to figure that all out.
Well, and then you go back in our history, World War II, they drafted everybody. I mean, didn't care about your sexual orientation, didn't care about who you thought you were. You're going to go in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard. Okay. And as soon as the war was over, you know, in the drawdown, if you were not considered politically reliable, you were allowed to get out of the Army or get out of the military. You know, not, and a lot of people that were in the military at the time had to hide who they were so they could serve. And some of the stuff's happening now. People have to hide who they are to serve because of policies. But if it's total war, man, nobody gives a hoot. You get your friction wherever you want to, 30 miles from the flagpole, but we're going to fight a war and you're coming with us. So.
So do you, obviously you focus on the combat. Do you focus on some of the political thriller angles? Because for instance, in World War II with the Lend-Lease, we were sort of the Freedom's Factory, if you would, because we were so far from the front that we could do that. Obviously then getting it across the oceans made the naval campaign very important. We've destroyed most of our infrastructure. We're mostly a consumer economy now.
Yes.
Right. So yes. If something ever happened, we recently learned with the COVID stuff, like we don't make any of our own medicine anymore. When the world shuts down, we're kind of SOL. Does that come up in the political thriller side? Because if Korea starts making it, South Korea, maybe North Korea makes a play. There's nobody watching the back door, right? Because America and the West is occupied. What's to stop Kim Jong-un or his kids, whoever at the time, from rushing that parallel?
That's kind of my next book. So
we spent a lot of time like,
you just outed me, man.
One of the things, like, I remember we had a sergeant major from a specific National Guard unit who I will not name because I will not badmouth the unit. We were in BIOP doing a drop there and we were getting ready to leave and he got really angry at three of the guys that worked for me. So they were a specialist in a PFC and two PFCs because they didn't stop and, you know the soldier creed and all that nonsense, which, you know, has value. It's a teaching discipline, teaching values. I don't knock it, but in the middle of a war zone, it's not the most important thing, right? And we were, like I said, BIOP was not, Baghdad International Airport, the green zone, if you would, was not a safe place at the time.
Yeah.
My perspective is if he has time to memorize that, he should be cleaning his rifle or fixing his truck or any number of things. I mean, we would sit in the mess hall and we would use our food as sand tables and we'd be like wargaming out. Like, if this happens, what do you do? Because the idea is you teach people to think on their feet, right?
Absolutely.
People forget that when war is going on, everything changes. And so it's just interesting to think about what that might look like. So like we wargamed everything. Tater tots became gun trucks and ketchup packets became the bad guy. And when we killed them, you got to eat them. Like, it was just one of those things you did, right? Like,
yeah.
And people forget like what that looks like at the lower level. And then when you read about war, a lot of times they're talking about the colonels and the captains, you know, everybody so far removed from danger that I think you lose a lot of opportunities where you could just show what it's like on the front lines.
Yeah. I've worked for many sergeant majors. A couple of them are just total assholes and, you know, get off my grass. What are you doing? Push-ups, this, that, just totally being a dick. But every time we went to the range and Joe had live ammo, they were really polite. So they were fakers, you know, and they exist everywhere. You know, after you've been deployed two or three times and you come back and you go to a post and, you know, you have to like get a loan from Army Emergency Relief to get all your shit sewn on your uniform. And then you see these leaders that are flatliners. They don't have jump wings. They don't have any kind of combat badges. And, you know, you got to ask why. And then they don't have a deployment patch. So there's folks that dodged the war on terror really effectively. And you'd hear about guys that would go to the airport in their whatever uniform, duty uniform they were, on leave so they could get upgraded seats and things like that. So there's always somebody with angles trying to play the system. Yeah, I don't like those guys. But
there's also the iconic ones that you could use as a model. Was it Eric Daly, I think his name was? He's the one that was in We Were Soldiers. The good morning, Sergeant Major. Who said it's a good goddamn morning? That iconic line.
Basil Plumley.
That's good. Yeah, and his other famous one was when they asked him why he didn't have a rifle. He said, by the time I need one, there'll be plenty laying around.
Damn like, straight.
Those characters exist too, so there's definitely room to show the whole spectrum of what that looks like, good, well, bad, and ugly.
Let me jump in real quick. You know, people see the Army as a monolithic juggernaut, but you have everything you have in society because everyone comes from all walks of life, all persuasions, all everything. You have the same stuff going in the Army that you have going on in society.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's when politicians try to talk about, we're going to use the Army for this, we're going to use the Army for that. No one's asked a soldier. So it creates unique opportunities for excellence. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, that's the other thing, that there's also every time something new happens, most of the strategies come from the ground up, not the other way around. I remember being on sat phones talking to Vietnam gun truck operators trying to figure out, like, what tactics did you use? And when we put together the SOP for battalion, we were like looking at old actual horse mounted cav manuals, looking at light infantry manuals. Yeah, I mean, people get creative. So there's definitely room for you to show, you know, Private Smith, whatever, coming up with some creative tactics for this new equipment because nobody's thought of it. And generally speaking, the less experienced you are, the more creative you can be because no one's told you what's not possible.
You don't have bad habits. Right. And you're thinking outside the box because once you've been institutionalized, I don't care if it's whatever you do, once you've been institutionalized, you're going to be resistant to, oh, well, we didn't develop that. That's bullshit. And that's not what good leaders do. They'll take ideas. And I think in my sixth book, I kind of broached that because you have all these experiences that come together in a unit.
So,
you could be standing next to a .com millionaire. You never know. I mean, because the uniform hides everything.
So in your story, it looks like you're all over the place. Is there a common highway through all of these where it's like one character, a couple of characters that cross over? Like, what is the linking factor in all these books?
So the first book, I introduced kind of my main character. It's a captain. She's a sapper. Her name is Lisa Brown. She had a full ride scholarship to a university that she lost when the wartime, you know, the War Powers Act came together. And, you know, she's kind of squared away and, you know, has a dad that took care of her and everything. And she picks her poison rather than have it picked for in a draft and walks into an Army recruiter. And then she has her experiences and goes from, you know, I'm a sapper in a, you know, I'm a demolitionist in a sapper platoon all the way up. No, I haven't told the stories yet, but the insinuation and implied is that she worked her way up going to OCS. Now she's a captain and she's in charge. So I take her as far as lieutenant colonel. And it's a lot of fun. And I wrote my book in such a way that you couldn't determine the gender until the end, you know, because guess what? There's a lot of women out there and they make great decisions too. Let's go with that. I just wanted to have that in there. And she kind of binds it all together. I have a Space Force pilot. I have a couple of Navy astronauts that kind of pop up here and there. I've got a couple of Air Force pilots that pop up here and there. But the common theme is the world's at war, and how are we going to do this, and what's going to happen next?
I muted myself. Do you have any surprises without spoilers with some of the alliances that didn't go the way people expect?
Like, oh, absolutely.
What if France sided with Russia for some weird reason? Or, I don't know.
Shh.
Well, that's book seven. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I mean, that's the thing about a fictional universe. You can do whatever you want. You can think of whatever you want. And that's given me a lot of creative freedom. So, I think in my sixth, in Sky Soldiers, I actually look at the King's Royal Hussars, which is an armored regiment. You know, they're equipped with, in my book, they're equipped with Ajax fighting vehicles and Challenger 3 tanks. Okay, how do they interact? What happened to them? And I use, there's a couple of pop culture references. They're pretty astute, but I hope you all remember Adam Ant and what he's doing now. That's all I'm going to say.
Do you touch on the role of like PMCs, professional military corps, I guess, or MERCs, which is what we call them?
I haven't touched on that yet. I've kept my activity with traditional armed forces. There's room for, like I said, when you start expanding the scope from, okay, we're going to go from Central Europe and now we've expanded the whole globe, there's things that can come out everywhere. I mean, right now in the news, the Wagner mercenaries, or the former Wagner mercenaries, are in Africa. And they've actually had Ukrainian special forces going down there and knocking off Wagner special forces as payback for what happened. So it's a complex landscape, man. It's like, it's not Chinese checkers, man. It's almost like that 3D chess in Star Trek. You've got to think like 20 moves ahead and be on your toes. I mean, it's heads up ball. So
do you have some sort of place where you keep all the lore together? Like some authors will do websites where they do almost like their universe Bible is out there for the public. Other people keep it to themselves. Is that something you're tracking?
What I want to do, I mean, as popularity increases, as sales increases, as spare time increases, I do want to have a webpage. Kind of hoping somebody at Wargate, I want to do that. I mean, I love to interact. Okay. One of my interactions, I keep it. I've saved it. I had a feedback on, what was it? Crimson Red and Navy Blue. And this guy was insinuating I had a head injury because he says it's the same as, you know, old heads and drone drivers. And I'm like, this guy just fat fingered it. And then come to find out I fat fingered it. So I had to get on a couple of web pages, a couple of sites and do a mea culpa and, you know, had to give instructions on how to get the right book, make sure I worked with the guys at PubShare are amazing. Okay. That whole group at PubShare has been so supportive and they've helped me, and I've offered to send him my social security number so he can put me down as a dependent on his taxes. He's done so much for me.
So they uploaded the wrong file.
Oh gosh, man, I was in a hurry but now that the right book is under the right title, I'm hoping people will find it and find it very entertaining.
Okay. Now you mentioned, is the order that it's listed on Amazon that we went through it? You said one of them was a prequel.
So the order that they're listed in is the order that they come out. Okay. I try to do at the beginning, you know, if it is a prequel, identify it as a prequel and tell the reader where it comes in the order of things.
So do you have a listed, well, will you, when you put together your website, a recommended reading order, if they wanted to read the stories chronologically by universe, not by pub date?
Yes, that's an amazing idea. And I will plagiarize the crap out of it.
Oh, I stole it from other people who stole it from other people. This is the way of the world. Okay. Was there anything about this universe that we didn't talk about? Because otherwise I'll get far in a field just, you know, getting nerdy about, you know, global politics.
You know,
the possibilities of tomorrow.
The things that I'm really focusing on, again, politics is not, I don't want to play in politics. I don't want to alienate anyone, you know? So the politics is kind of like, if there's anything political in my books, it's kind of like a breathing space before we get right back into the hardcore action. And, you know, cause I feel the need to throw some of that in there because for the trying to increase the understanding and the situational awareness of the leader, right. Or the reader, excuse me. And, you know, I want to tell it from the guy on the ground's view. The guy on the ground, I mean, we saw it in, I mean, we're seeing it in Masters of the Air. We're seeing it in Band of Brothers. We're seeing it in the Pacific. You know, we're seeing that, you know, Nick Cole and his series, especially when they start talking about Tyrus Rex, you're seeing it. Strange Company, you're seeing it. You're seeing the guy on the ground. And, I mean, everybody could write a book about MacArthur or Patton or Zhukov or whoever. But the guy on the ground is the dude that finally has to establish national policy from 1 to 300 meters and make it happen. And that's the point of view I want to use for most of it.
So did you ever consider not using existing political figures for your president, your vice president, and for your global politicians just to avoid that?
So it was a turmoil that I had for about 27 seconds and just run what you brought. Just go after it and make it happen. I don't include dates or timelines or anything like that in the books. I want them to be able to stand alone for an entertainment value. And I feel that if I start actual dates and everything, I kind of push it towards reality, and that's not what I want to do. I want to show how awful war is so we don't fall in love with it.
Okay. All right. So this is the part of the interview, dear listener, where I remind you to please be kind and speak your mind on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right books. We've gone way over the topic of his Breaching Ain't Easy universe. We will link to the series page in the show notes so you can follow along, buy the books. Right now, they're not that expensive. I think for like $10, you can get all of them right now.
Yeah.
Is there any plans in the future for audio and print?
There's always a plan. I think what I'm going to do this holiday season, the upcoming holiday season at the end of the year, is I'm going to take probably the three best stories that I have and I'm going to combine them. Of course, I'm going to go back and edit the crap. I mean, my first stories, I leave the mistakes in right now because it shows me how far I've come. But I want to combine about two or three of the stories into maybe about 40, 50,000 word novel or little novel. And I'll explore the options of going through and having it in print and maybe having, I don't know, I can't afford, I might have to read it myself and to get it into audio form. And hopefully my Texas drawl doesn't come out too much and contaminate the series. But it's a lot of things I have planned.
So how long is each of the novel? Is it full novel length? Is it?
Oh, no. They're... I think the longest one is probably about 16,000 words.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So they're the novella.
Novella. Okay.
Yeah. And what it is in my development as an author, you know, I had some folks go, well, tell me why. Why does this person want to do it? Oh, well, they're in a uniform and they're at war. No. What are the emotions? What are the feelings? What are, you know, and try to develop a better bond with the consumer that they'll be interested and want to follow the next story. And if you read them all in the order that they were published, I'm hoping you see that the writing's getting better, that everything is that I'm improving. And I don't claim to be perfect. I'm also very gracious and have a lot of gratitude to people that have helped me here. We mentioned Law Dog, we mentioned Cedar Sanderson, I mentioned an old NFO. And others, I mean, it takes a village to raise an author. Anyone that can stomp their feet and said, I did it all by themselves, nah, man, you had help. I mean, there might be the one savant that's out there that can do it, or two or three of them, but everybody's got to lean on somebody for support. And I am very grateful and gracious and have tons of gratitude for the folks that have helped me.
Okay. So, yeah, it looks like if you're assuming they're all about 16,000, you could fit all five of what's out right now in the in one book. That's about 96,000 if my math holds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, some of the first ones are a little shorter. I'm getting up to that 16,000 word threshold. Hopefully with the next one, I can break 20,000. You know, I'm not ready to write War and Peace just yet. So it's, again, it's a growth and development thing for me. And what I'm finding is that keeping my mind working helps me with my mood. It helps me with my attitude. And, you know, because I'm no spring chicken anymore. So I want to be able to, do this for a few more years. And hopefully the consumer will allow me to do that. That just sounds so much like so much fun to me right now.
Okay. So you're working on book six right now?
Seven.
Seven. Okay. So some of them are with the publishing company then?
I self-publish. So I enter my stuff into PubShare, and that's how I blast it out to ebooks for the consumer to purchase. You know, I've had a lot of help. I mean, Law Dog told me how. Old NFO, like I said, he'll make sure that my he'll definitely make sure that my aviation jargon is very on point. But it's been a journey of self-learning. I mean, going through traditional publishing for me was not an option. I did not think I had an audience through traditional publishing to sell my idea to Simon & Schuster or someone that large. I mean, because, you know, and I was encouraged to self-publish. I know there's some folks at Raconteur Press that want to get me down there and give me some more lessons. And trust you, I know I have a lot more to learn. But it's given me the freedom to write what I want. And I mean, my editor, when he gets after it, it's for content and clarity. He's not changing the meanings. He's not changing it. Oh, for political correctness, I don't have that. And it gives you a lot of creative freedom. Now, it's hard as hell. I mean, because you got to juggle your life. You have to juggle work. You have to juggle, you know, sitting down every day. You have to have a lot of discipline to sit down, you know, 2 days a week and crank out 2,000 words. And, but it's also very rewarding. I remember when I published my first book, and you're going into PubShare because they track those things. And I sold my first two books and it felt like I'd finished a marathon. You know, it just like the creative juices flowing. I said, two people actually bought it and they reviewed it. Oh my God, what's next? And, let the market tell you where to go. It hasn't been, I'm going to say struggle, but I use that term. I don't use that term like I really struggled. I use that term like you're learning something new. It's almost like taking I can ride a bicycle really well. Well, let's give you this Harley Davidson, you know, electric glide. Go learn on that. This is scary. So, you know, making that progression from independent author to world famous guy. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but like I said, I just want my work to entertain somebody, and I just feel amazing doing it.
Okay. And where can listeners follow you if they want to track you down to follow your work?
The Angry Jumpmaster on Substack is where I do a lot of my explanation of why I'm developing this fictional thing. And I also share updates on when books are published, when I share the artwork, because it's good. You're flashing that stuff on screen and I got goosebumps. So I've been very fortunate that I've met a lot of good people that help. I mean, listen, again, it takes a village, man. Doing this all by yourself is hard. It's also a lot of fun.
Okay. And you can find us, dear listener, on our Linktree, linktr.ee, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, Linktree/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the BitChutes, the Rumbles, the YouTubes, the Twitters, our email for professional purposes only, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. Again, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. We have our Facebook group and our new Facebook page. And more importantly, if you want to send the hate mail, Madam Stabby Stabs, Instagram, Twitter, and email are all linked in the link tree. You can follow us on our website at anchor.fm/blasterstackyandtackblades. Again, anchor.fm/blasterstackyandtackblades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. These episodes aren't free to produce, and we appreciate your patronage. You could support the show more directly by going to buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it is for the podcast, and I will keep my co-host duly caffeinated. They will drink until the coffee pours out their eyes. Speaking of coffee, as usual, we are affiliated with the Coffee Brand Coffee Company. We have a link for you to click in the show notes. Type in Podcast Grunts for the discount code, and you get 10% off. It's American-made, well, American-roasted. I'm sure we don't grow all the beans in the USA, but it is an American company. It's not just a drop shipping operation. They actually have a roasting plant here, employs like 40 people. You get coffee, tea, hot cocoa, snacks. It's the work. It's good. Stabby and I drink it exclusively. Well, not exclusively, because I'm also drink the cheap stuff, but we drink it when we want to be bougie. And with that being said, thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my crazy and absentee co-host, I am J.R. Hanley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. All right, thanks for coming on, James. This was a lot of fun. We're going to have you back playing that drone operation.
I am so grateful that however the comedy errors that we got linked up and did this. This is a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity.
It was. Enjoy. And hopefully everyone goes and checks those books out and gives it a shot. All right. And –